It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, laws passed 50 years ago aimed to end racial segregation, but segregation still persists in Milwaukee, Madison, and communities around the country. Our guest digs into some of the possible reasons behind that.
First, Saturday Night Live took on Wisconsin this weekend with a new sketch, Fond du Lac Action News. We've got a link on the Central Time Facebook page if you want to check it out. You haven't seen it. But the anchors are all wearing these quilted vests. They have these outrageous accents. I guess they're supposed to be Wisconsin accents.
Here's what it all sounded like.
You're watching Southeastern Wisconsin's award-winning news team. Top of the hour from the bottom of the lake. This is Fond du Lac Action News.
I'm Trish Wisniewski.
I'm Joe Bush.
And here's your news, Fond du Lac. Let's get to tonight's top story. So, outrage as the hearing date's been set to determine where recently released sex offender Jim Heinzel lives.
Oh, God. I hope it doesn't get Judge Briggs, because she fined me $300 for going through a stop-and-go light by the Pizza Hut that I know is yellow.
Joe, yellow? I've driven with you. Come on.
It's far from the only time Wisconsin got a mention in the pop culture world. You know, Laverne and Shirley, Happy Days, both in the Milwaukee area. Also, the kids from That 70s Show and fictional Point Place, Wisconsin.
And here to help us sort out how Wisconsin fares in pop culture is Wisconsin's most beloved export, Stephen Thompson. Stephen is an editor and reviewer at NPR Music and a contributor on NPR's Pop Culture Happy Hour. Stephen, welcome back.
Oh, it's great to be here.
So Saturday Night Live does a send-up of Wisconsin news, specifically Fond du Lac. What do you think?
Or as they called it, Fond du Lac.
Fond du Lac.
The entire time.
In southeastern Wisconsin, too.
In south, what? Yeah. Yeah, Fond du Lac isn't really in southeastern Wisconsin, is it? Mm. Yeah, I mean, I've got to assume that somebody associated with Saturday Night Live was watching Making a Murderer and got a little obsessed with the accents. It was funny. I don't usually watch Saturday Night Live, and I happened to have it on when that sketch came on and just sort of sat there just marveling at how terrible those accents were.
So it's not just me, because, I mean, in this job, I hear a lot of accents from around the state. I've been around the state a lot. I have not, I mean, that accent's kind of floating around, for one thing, what they were doing. And I can't say I've heard it in this state before.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, Jonah Hill, that sketch, the main voices you're hearing at the top of that sketch are Cecily Strong and Jonah Hill. And Cecily Strong's got it's at least an approximation of some of the voices of people you might talk to living there. I lived in Wisconsin for decades. Jonah Hill, I don't even know what Jonah Hill's doing there.
Sort of a little like somebody from Chicago impersonating Fargo, maybe? I don't know.
Maybe.
Some of our listeners disagree, though, and they thought that they did sort of nail the accents of Wisconsin.
Facebook,
I mean, I've been to Fond du Lac. I don't remember people sounding like that. Could be wrong. Now I feel like I'm lapsing into it as I talk. Do I sound like that?
Oh my gosh. Like,
yeah. I think we're all bound to do that every now and then. It's all in the voles, you know.
The voles. See, but was that a compliment, that sketch? Because I used to feel like it was sort of flattering when you saw people from Wisconsin portrayed on TV or film. It was shorthand for being nice and maybe a little folksy, but I don't know. Are people starting to see Wisconsin, I don't know, do they think we're dorks, I guess is what I'm asking.
As more of a malevolent force. I mean, isn't Wisconsin, I mean, so much of the Wisconsin persona, though, is about self-deprecation and about embracing more, you know, more like big city people making fun of them. I mean, if you think about people wearing the cheddar heads, you know, Packer fans or whatever, that started with, like, people in Chicago saying, oh, you know wait, just left into a Wisconsin accent to imitate a Chicago person. That's how long I've been away from the Midwest. But, you know, that wearing the wedges of cheese on the head was kind of, you know, steering into the skid of like embracing a goofy stereotype about Wisconsin people. I think there's a lot of self-deprecation and a lot of, you know, oh, we're just goofing around, you know, that Wisconsin people have. That I don't necessarily, it was not a particularly cutting commentary on people in Wisconsin. It was largely, I felt like, you know, making fun of you know, a newscast where there isn't that much dark news to report. I mean, I remember one of the first times I came back to Wisconsin after I moved to Washington, D.C., and, you know, I was visiting family up near Green Bay, and the lead story was about a series of snowmobile thefts, and I just thought, I have got to move back here.
Talking to Stephen Thompson from NPR, Wisconsin expatriate, pop culture expert. Well, let's talk about Wisconsin pop culture more generally, Stephen. We mentioned, you know, Happy Days, Laverne and Shirley, that 70s show. You know, the lead guy in news radio was supposed to be in New York from Wisconsin. Mm. So what does it mean when the creators of these shows throw Wisconsin out there as the cultural point of reference?
I mean, I think it's very common. You see this a lot, and Wisconsin's not alone in this, that, you know, these shows are all set in New York or L.A. They're all made by people who live in New York or L.A. And I think there's a lot of putting a finger on the map somewhere in the middle. And, and what's nice, I think, about the way Wisconsin tends to get treated is it's a little bit less likely to get that treatment of, like, if I don't succeed out here in the cruel business I'm in, I'll have to go back to Iowa. And you see that a lot, like, oh, she's from Indiana and God, she escaped that hellhole. Or like you watch The Bachelor and there's The Bachelor this season is from Indiana. There was one where the guy was from Iowa and they would just depict it as if it was this, you know, just this this backwater hellhole. And I think Wisconsin gets a little bit of a pass and is viewed as a little bit more of a playful place and not necessarily, and maybe that's just my own view of it coloring this perception. But there seems to be less like, wow, what a miserable place to live that must be, says somebody who's lived it, never left any of the five boroughs or never left L.A.
Do you, Stephen, own a quilted vest?
I do not.
I don't either.
I feel like I should get one now.
I did like my vest, and I'm asking because I did have friends. They were from Chicago, but they made fun of me for my vest wearing. So I'm wondering if that is a thing. Do people in Wisconsin wear more vests, perhaps quilted?
Used to have a quilted vest. Uh-huh. It was reversible, black one side, plaid on the other. I love that vest. I may get another. And now I have a quilted plaid flannel. That I'll pull out often as an underlayer for a coat. It's not always my.
We don't want to hear about your underlayer.
You know, I've been away almost 10 years now, and so I have not been able to keep up with all of the latest and cutting edge Wisconsin fashion trends. But I when you think about the way Wisconsin, like I said, embraced the cheesehead. I mean, if people decided that was a stereotype about people in Wisconsin, I think sales of that stuff would go up in Wisconsin. Like, people would wear it with pride. Mm-hmm. A lot of the Wisconsin expatriates I know in D.C., you know, that I, you know, you find pockets of them and you talk about the Packers and, is, you know, they wear their Wisconsin with pride. Like, I wear my Wisconsin probably more proudly having left. Like, I like to represent, you know, since I'm not in my home state.
And we thank you for it. So Stephen, do you feel like, do people say to you in Washington on the East Coast, do they say that you've got a Wisconsin accent? Do they hear it on you? Or have you kind of, you know, sloughed it off?
Part of it is, you know, when I'm on the air, the NPR affect, you tend to flatten out any accent you might have as much as possible, in part because you're wearing headphones, and so you're able to modulate your speech a little bit more. My Wisconsin accent comes and goes. You know, I moved to Wisconsin when I was 10. I definitely marinated in it enough that I can kind of weave in and out. But like a lot of people who have, you know, if you grew up in the South, people you know who grew up in the South, sometimes their Southern accent will only come out when they're mad.
Right.
For me, my Wisconsin accent will only come out when I'm talking about football.
And speaking of football, I think the brand most people think about with Wisconsin is the Packers. And when you watch the Packers when they're on national TV, there's always the B-roll, the images of a field of cows, maybe a sauerkraut factory, especially when Madden was still doing commentaries. I mean, is that what people pops into people's minds when they think Wisconsin, the brats, the sauerkraut, the dairy?
Well, it used to drive me crazy, like particularly when the Packers were in the Super Bowl in 96-97, and the networks would do these profiles of like, things are different in Green Bay, Wisconsin. You know, like, people there are just folks, it's just a land out of time. No, it's not. There are places in America that are lands out of time. When I think of rural Wisconsin, I think of ready access to Walmart. And I wouldn't necessarily, you know, think of it as some bizarrely old-fashioned place unlike any other. I love Wisconsin. I want to go back and visit Wisconsin.
Well, come back. You can sit in this chair right here, Stephen, and talk to us. I just banged on the chair.
That
I don't
was
know
the
if
sound
you can hear
of the
that.
Chair.
Well, Stephen, thanks. It's always good to talk to you.
It's always great. Thanks, guys.
That's Stephen Thompson, editor and reviewer at NPR Music, contributor on NPR's Pop Culture Happy Hour. He joined us to look at how Wisconsin looks through the lens of pop culture. Civil rights laws passed in the 1960s aimed to put an end to racial segregation in the United States in schools, housing, public services, and employment. Previously, legal barriers to integration were torn down.
But even with those changes in the law, segregation didn't go away. In many parts of the country, researchers have found that schools are as segregated as they were in the 1960s. And many communities in the country still see sharp divisions of black and white neighborhoods, with the Milwaukee metropolitan area ranked as the most segregated in the country.
In a recent piece in The Atlantic, our next guest asks why segregation is hanging around decades after massive changes in civil rights laws. Adia Harvey Wingfield is a professor of sociology at Washington University in St. Louis. She's the author of the book No More Invisible Man, Race and Gender in Men's Work. Adia, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for the invitation. I'm happy to be here.
So the laws that allowed legal segregation changed, but real life segregation remains. Why is that?
Well, there's a lot of research that looks at that and finds that while the laws have stopped allowing segregation to continue explicitly, a lot of the processes that maintain segregation and racial inequality at large continue to manifest themselves. So while it's no longer legal for people to say, I explicitly will not sell my house to someone who's a racial minority, a lot of the practices that are in place that make it more difficult for people of color, black Americans in particular, to have access to higher credit, have access to higher amounts of money for down payments, or to be able to be in the know about access to real estate, or to have connections to real estate agents who may or may not steer them to certain areas of the city that they want to live in, can still be an issue. So it's still not a matter of just having enough money to live in the area where you want to. Other structural processes come into play that can still make it difficult for racial integration to really occur in neighborhoods.
And you write that decisions made by possibly well-meaning white people who have no conscious intention to recreate segregation can lead to neighborhood segregation. How does that play out?
Right. There's an excellent book that talks about this in a lot of detail, but it's by Thomas Shapiro, and it's called The Hidden Cost of Being African American. And one of the things that Shapiro finds in his book is that for many white families, there's no obvious overt intention to say, I'm simply not going to live in a diverse neighborhood. Some people will even say explicitly that they want diversity in neighborhoods. But then what happens is that people make choices about their home ownership, and they make choices about where they want to live. And a lot of that is driven by educational opportunities, or what they perceive to be educational opportunities available for their children. But many times, rather than taking into consideration factors like class size or teacher quality, things that are proven to make a difference in educational mobility and educational attainment, people racialize school choice, and they decide that the schools that they want their children to attend are schools that are primarily white and in certain neighborhoods that are racially exclusive. So what happens is that Shapiro finds that often white families make decisions that are coded by virtue of things related to race and class and don't really reflect accurate measures of school success, and that those decisions lead them to make choices about where they want to live in ways that reproduce racial segregation. They look for predominantly white neighborhoods because they believe that predominantly white neighborhoods equal better neighborhoods, and that predominantly white schools equal better schools. That's not always the case, but often that becomes the decision-making factor that drives how people make choices about their residential patterns, and that ends up reproducing the racial segregation that persists.
Now, through that piece in The Atlantic I mentioned, you are in some ways implicitly, maybe directly, arguing against ideas that, well, this is some kind of pathology, maybe a culture of poverty, as people used to call it, something that comes from African-American people themselves. Do you think that that argument, first of all, is commonly made as a reason for this sort of unintentional segregation?
Yeah, I do think that we still see echoes of people who persist in endorsing or perpetuating the culture of poverty argument, but I don't think that, at least in the data and research that I've seen, there is necessarily a lot of support for the merits of the culture of poverty argument. I think that if you look at the research on neighborhood segregation and residential patterns, I think that you're much less likely to see cases where there are people of color who persist in living around each other and not adopting the correct or appropriate values that lead them to experience economic or residential mobility. But often what happens is that people still persist in using racial stereotypes. People rely on what they think that they know about people of color, racial minorities in particular, and that drives a lot of housing patterns and a lot of housing decisions, much more so than the culture of poverty arguments.
You mentioned your connections to a network, knowing a real estate agent who would be willing to point you toward, nudge you toward one neighborhood or another. You also, in your piece, mentioned that sort of networking, that connection issue when it comes to finding jobs. So talk about how that plays out.
Right. One of the things that I've learned from doing my own research and reading that of my colleagues is that social networks matter enormously in shaping access to work. And this happens when we're talking about professional occupations. This happens when we're talking about non-professional occupations. And that many times, because our social networks often remain very racially exclusive, people of color can easily become locked out of the access to, or the networks to allow them to access particularly high-profile professional positions that will facilitate upward mobility. So while we like to think of jobs as being things that are driven solely by merit and driven solely by the best person being the one who gets the job for which they apply, often that's not necessarily what happens. In many cases, people's connections, the presumptions that employers and managers have about who's, quote, a good fit, the idea of what sociologists describe as soft skills, the ability to seem like you're a person who fits a job, the ability to seem like you're a person who has certain intangible qualities, can really work to disadvantage people of color in jobs where they're in the minority.
And on top of all that, you point out that white people tend to be economically better off than African Americans, and that allows white parents to pass that on to their kids to get them set up in education, mortgage, what have you.
Right. If I can return to the Shapiro book, one of the things that I found most compelling about that book was that in addition to what I just described in terms of white families using schools and the racial and class compositions of schools as kind of a shorthand for school success, the other thing that facilitates segregated neighborhoods or the persistence of segregated neighborhoods is that due to the transfer of intergenerational wealth, white families are often able to draw from extended family members, parents, grandparents, whomever, who can pass down sizable sums that then become used as a down payment or used as money for even college loans or to finance large expensive things that then don't become things that people have to take out loans for. For people of color, particularly those who are professionals or in the middle class, and particularly African Americans, often that's not the case. Instead of a vertical transfer of wealth, what we often see is something that operates at a more horizontal level. Whereas if someone is a professional, if someone works at a professional white collar job, they may be more likely to have to loan money or give out financial gifts to siblings, to cousins, to aunts and uncles, to parents if they're Black American. And what that does is that means that person then has a lower amount of money saved that they can then use to put down as a down payment for a house and then reduce their interest payments on that house and move into the neighborhood of their choosing. So this idea of the intergenerational transfer of wealth and the ways in which white families are advantaged, I think really couples with the preferences or the racialized preferences about schools and neighborhood choice that help to keep segregation ongoing in residential areas.
Talking to Adia Harvey-Wingfield from Washington University about why segregation persists over five decades after laws that were supposed to end it. And Adia, so it was a huge effort to change laws to get to the Civil Rights Act of the 1960s, and that still didn't do the job. So what, given that, what would have to change to end the practical neighborhood segregation, school segregation, economic segregation we see in this country?
Right. Well, that's the million-dollar question. That clearly the laws that were passed in the 1960s, I think, reflected a lot of the racial practices that were prevalent and widespread previous to or prior to that time period. They reflected the fact that overt segregation was commonplace and very widespread in many places. They reflected the ways in which those rules about overt segregation led to overt practices where people couldn't access jobs, housing, public spaces, and so forth. We don't have that at this time period, but what we do have are covert practices that still reproduce a lot of those same outcomes. So some of the research that I've done talks about the challenges that Black professionals face in predominantly white occupational settings, where, again, no one will say explicitly, we're not going to hire you, but people still operate based on stereotypes in terms of hiring, in terms of decisions about who might be management material, in terms of decisions about who is a colleague with whom someone wants to work, and so forth. So I think that one one of the things that's happening right now that's useful is that there are more social movements where people are drawing attention to the persistence of these types of issues. People often are critical of the Black Lives Matter movement, but I think one of the things that's valuable about that movement is that it does draw attention to the persistence of racial inequality in many different subsets and many different forms. I think that we also see examples of students of color on college campuses today who are protesting and drawing attention to the types of challenges and inequities that they face. Again, they get criticized because people perceive them as being whiny or being spoiled or being too coddled or not wanting to engage in dialogue. But one of the things that is valuable about what they're doing is that they're drawing attention to the ways that these issues continue to perpetuate themselves. So I think that with more visibility, this becomes a way for us to crystallize and identify what the issues are now, the ways in which they're manifested, and then to enact public policy and law that can reflect the contemporary manifestations of inequality.
Adia, we'll leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much for the invitation.
That was Adia Harvey Wingfield, professor of sociology at Washington University in St. Louis, talking about the persistence of segregation. She had a recent piece in The Atlantic about that, and she's the author of the book No More Invisible Man, Race and Gender in Men's Work.
We're digging into some news from the UW system. Professor Sarah Goldrick Rabb announced she's leaving Wisconsin to accept a job at Temple University in Pennsylvania. She'll continue to be a professor of higher education policy, and sociology in her new position.
The news comes at a time when UW-Madison is spending millions to try to retain the university's star faculty members. Tenure changes and a $250 million state funding cut to the UW system in the current state budget have a lot of UW faculty members worried about the future. And officials at UW-Milwaukee are struggling to figure out where to cut millions of dollars from their campus.
Karen Herzog has been writing about this, and she's here to share the details. She's a higher education reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Karen, welcome back.
Thank you, Veronica.
Well, is keeping top faculty on board turning into an ongoing effort at UW-Madison?
I believe that's probably the case at all campuses, but UW-Madison especially actually has the resources to attempt to retain faculty. They have additional funds available to fend off any raiding of their top faculty.
Well, how much change have we seen in this retention effort since the news of the budget cuts?
Well, it's difficult to quantify how many offers have been made, and it's also difficult to sort out how many faculty have gone out into the market, you know, deciding that I want to leave because I'm concerned about the future here, and how many cases have been other universities seizing on an opportunity that, considering that faculty may be more willing to accept outside offers. I know that in the College of Letters and Sciences at UW-Madison, which is the largest college by far there, they've had about double the activity in the last 6 months of 2015, what they normally see for retention cases.
And I want to look more closely at those numbers, but first let's talk a little bit about a high-profile faculty member who has announced that she is leaving. Sarah Goldrick Rabb says she's taking a position at Temple University instead, and we talked to her on this program back in January when she said she was considering leaving, and here's a clip from that interview.
I love this place. I intended to remain here until I retired. I am no longer thinking of doing so, and there is only one reason for it, and that is Act 55, which was passed last summer.
And Act 55 being the law that changed tenure policy, Rabb thought for the worse. She says that true tenure has been undercut throughout the UW system. Where is that debate about the tenure policy today?
Well, Veronica, that debate is probably going to continue well beyond when the Board of Regents settles on a final policy, and that is supposed to happen on Thursday. There's a meeting Thursday morning in Madison, on the UW-Madison campus, and there have been recommendations made. There was a task force that met for several months and came up with a recommendation for a policy, and then the Education Committee of the UW System Board of Regents took that policy, made a couple of little tweaks, and then they approved the policy. So the full Board of Regents on Thursday will take a look at it, and they will decide, and what they decide will be, in fact, the policy, at least for now. Obviously, they could change it at some point down the road if they would like, which is something that concerns UW faculty, because it used to be in state statute, and they felt that it was safer, you know, being tucked into state statute. They felt that it would take more to change it or to weaken tenure. So things have shifted a little bit in that direction, but it appears that debate, or at least the decisions on what the policies will be, will come to a culmination on Thursday.
And Karen, I know that you look closely at the numbers that the UW-Madison has spent retaining faculty. We've got millions of dollars being spent for research support and hundreds of thousands for raises. Can you give us a sense about who's getting this money and what types of professors are the most sought after?
Well, it's interesting because the fields that these professors work in are pretty, you know, widely ranging. I mean, you have professors in the humanities. In fact, the professor who received the largest increase in pay is someone who actually works in the humanities. And let's see, what was her pay increase? I think it was $56,421. And she's an associate professor of sociology. She works with the Institute for Research on Poverty and the Center for Demography and Ecology. So here's a sociologist who's at the top of the pay increase scale. But you also have researchers who are in the STEM fields. There were three oncology professors, three cancer researchers, that is, who got the top research grants. And then there was another researcher who's in research is stem cells, and he also received a substantial grant. So these are people that one could perhaps predict based on, you know, the fields that are the most highly competitive and the highest paid. Several of those individuals would be out in the market and quite valuable there. But as I said, there are some in the humanities as well, some in the College of Letters and Science.
And the chancellor said, yeah, this is what is needed, this kind of money to retain these faculty members. There has been some criticism from faculty who aren't seeing this sort of effort to retain them, that morale is low and that maybe more energy should be focused there. What are you hearing?
Well, it depends on who you ask. Obviously, there's morale is an issue within the UW system, and that cuts across all campuses. Faculty have not gotten raises like these individuals did. In fact, there were no across-the-board raises at all this year, and I believe a couple years ago, faculty got like 1% raises, which was the same as other state employees. So there, you know, it's a lot like the marketplace, the private sector marketplace, where you have some who are rewarded, who are, you know, considered the stars, so to speak, and others who, you know, who do really good work but don't draw the same attention and feel like they aren't as appreciated or valued as much. And that's a difficult thing for a chancellor to manage on a campus, because obviously everyone is valued. But there's concern about losing the top talent, the ones that help the university maintain its world-class status.
We're talking with Karen Herzog right now from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, looking at some of the challenges that are facing the UW system in the wake of some state funding cuts. And Karen, it sounds as though there's a mix of optimism. You talked to some professors who've chosen to say, some faculty, and said they assume things will get better. You've talked to other people who said they're worried about the slow degradation of the UW system. Can you tell us about those two perspectives a bit?
Well, there again, I think some people are your perspective to some degree depends on whether you're a person who tends to be an optimist and whether you're a person who tends to think the worst. Now, I don't mean that's, you know, necessarily always the case here, but there are people who are more optimistic who I think look at the broader picture of the greatness of a university and say that it's not going to be eroded by one budget year, one biennial budget. But that's not to say that those who are really worried don't have reason to be worried at the same time, because it is true that over time you do have a reputation that could be eroded if you don't invest in the quality, and if you start to lose some of those key faculty, if you lose research money. All of those things are measured, you know, with metrics, and their, you know, rankings of colleges are a really big deal for both attracting faculty and students, and also research money. You know, there's a whole lot of things in play there for a university to stay on top of its game.
And moving on to another aspect of this, you've reported on what's happening at UW-Milwaukee. Now, leaders there are trying to cut millions from their budget while still maintaining the integrity of that institution. Give us a sense of what's happening at UW-Milwaukee.
Well, UW-Milwaukee has a unique mission. It's a mission that no other university in the public university system in Wisconsin has, and that is both to serve as an institution of access for urban students. Milwaukee, a lot of these kids are from MPS, and some of them may not be as well prepared for college as others. So there's a significant cost there for developmental education, is what it's called, and that's to get them up to speed so that they are ready for college. That's a very costly mission. And in addition to that, UWM has a research mission. And while it's not the flagship land-grant university in the state, it is an urban research university that has just been elevated to the R1 Carnegie classification status, which puts it in a top-tier group of 118 elite universities. So they have two very different expensive missions that they're trying to accomplish at the same time with funding cuts, and they also have a structural deficit that they're dealing with because they've lost enrollment the last few years. And when you lose enrollment, you lose tuition money, and tuition money is a big support of revenue.
And Karen, just briefly, UW-Madison, also an R1 research university. Does this mean that these two universities are now on equal footing?
Well, that's a really complex answer. If you ask the folks at Carnegie, the people who do the rank, they're not rankings, it's a classification, they will say that there's a set of metrics, and you basically add up the numbers for these various metrics, and whatever number you end up with is whether you're an R1 or the second class, I shouldn't say second class, an R2, that is. And so it's a numbers game to some degree. It's not considered a status or a ranking. However, to be amongst the top 115, top-tier research institutions does give UWM a certain status in terms of applying for certain research grants that only go to R1 institutions. So it's certainly an accomplishment, and it's certainly something that UWM officials probably can rightly be proud of, obviously. But it's not saying that they are in the same research level in terms of the quantity or the quality necessarily of what UW-Madison produces.
And we're talking to Karen Herzog right now from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. We're discussing some of the challenges that are facing the UW system in the face of state funding cuts.
Taking your calls at 800-642-1234. What do you think UW system campuses should do in the wake of these budget cuts? If you are at one of those campuses as a student, staff, or faculty, or administrator, what do you think? How is this affecting what you do? Do you worry about the quality of the UW eroding over time? How big a part does it play in the life of our state? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're continuing our discussion now about the challenges facing the UW system in the face of state funding cuts. UW-Madison is spending millions to try to retain key faculty members, and UW-Milwaukee is struggling to cut millions from their budget while maintaining the integrity of that institution.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think UW campuses should do to deal with these budget cuts? What kind of changes would you like to see? Do you think we have too many campuses around the state? Could we merge or consolidate them? What do you think of the role the UW system plays in the state, where it's going in the future? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And Karen, I wanted to get to calls pretty quickly here, but going back to UW-Milwaukee and the situation they're in, they have a frozen tuition right now. They have declining enrollment and state funding, which is not so simple comparatively. Tell us how UW-Milwaukee stacks up when it comes to the funding that they get.
Well, that's actually a really interesting question, because I always assumed that there was a formula that everybody knew how it worked and the history of it. And it turns out that there's not really a good history of that formula and how they determine how much UWM should get and how much the others should get. UWM gets substantially less per student than Madison. And interestingly, Superior gets quite a bit more than Milwaukee per student. Superior has a small enrollment. It's the smallest campus in the UW system, but obviously it still has fixed expenses. So it has to support its buildings, its faculty, its staff, and yet you have UWM with a much larger campus and a dual mission of research and access with less money per student.
And I want to go to our callers now, and we'll pick that up in a bit, but let's take Jim first in Madison. Jim, hi.
Hi, thanks. I'm wondering if your guest can address the UW colleges. I'm a faculty member in the UW colleges. We're also 13 campuses. You make the point that UW-Milwaukee is the point of access for urban students. We're the point of access for rural students. And we're an extremely important gateway to the four-year comprehensives in that we take underprepared high school students and prepare them for their junior and senior years on the four-year comprehensives. And, you know, we have an extremely important mission to that access for rural students, people who can't afford to move to a city or stay in a dorm or things like that. So, as a sidebar, you know, the faculty salaries in the UW colleges, there hasn't been any increase in years for us.
Jim, thanks a lot for the call. Appreciate the points you make there about the colleges being a point for rural students to get in the door at UW colleges. And Karen, we're entering sort of a discussion here where you have UW system president, for example, Ray Cross, saying it's unfair to compare funding for UW-Madison to UW-Milwaukee and the colleges comparing themselves to UW-Milwaukee. Tell us a little bit about the atmosphere that's going on right now and how the colleges are kind of competing with each other for resources.
Well, UW Colleges is an interesting position. As Jim pointed out, it is an access institution. And someone who's really interested in saving money can start out at UW Colleges, get their first 2 years under their belt, and like half the cost of tuition for like a UWM, and then transfer to UWM or UW-Madison or wherever else they would like to go. And obviously, UW Colleges is having the same budget pressures that the others are having. And in the case of colleges, they are doing some changes where they're consolidating the management of campuses. Instead of having a dean at every single campus, they have a dean over four campuses or a few campuses, and they're kind of changing their structure to try to become more efficient. But they are, as Jim said, in a really unique position to educate a large share of Wisconsin students who aren't ready for a four-year college or don't need a four-year education.
Jim, thanks a lot for that call. And UW-Milwaukee, you said it gets far less on the tuition dollar than, say, UW-Madison gets. And how is that funding formula currently being looked at right now? Are people looking at revamping that?
Yes, there's a team of UW system administrators that's looking at that formula. And essentially, when you talk about formula, it's a base funding approach. So whatever they got last year, they will get a percentage if there's, say, there's a cut of $250 million as occurred in this current biennium. Each campus is assigned a percentage. Madison gets 50% of the cut, or if there's an increase, they get 50% of the increase, and then all the other campuses are given their percentage. They're looking at the formula and whether it needs to be changed, and if so, how much. That isn't going to happen in the next year or two. It's going to take a while, and nobody really knows what that's going to be, but it's a formula that was established long ago, before UWM was the institution that it is, and some of the other campuses, too, have evolved. So it's time to take a fresh look at that.
And another caller is next. We've got Duke with us from Milwaukee. Duke, hi.
Hi. I think that the university in Milwaukee needs to have a subject that's so darn interesting and exciting that it attracts attention and people from all over the world. Madison has done that. They've had stem cell research and a number of other interesting things, and I just don't think that that's happening here. The truth of the matter, this is not an economic problem so much as it is the ability of the university to attract people.
Duke, thanks a lot for your thoughts on that. And Karen, is that part of it? Is UW-Milwaukee not doing the research, just getting the attention, getting the grants, for instance?
Well, Duke makes a really interesting point about, you know, every university has to have the things, that, whether it's majors or whatever it is that it has that attracts students, that makes people sit up and take notice. In Madison, they have the research reputation. In UWM, I don't know if it's regarded, if you think first of all of research, but UWM has really made a name for itself in water research, and the newest School of Freshwater Science, and that's something that they're trying to develop. It's got a highly regarded school of education, engineering, business. There are schools that are well regarded, but Duke is right that there's not one program necessarily that pops up as oh my gosh, you have to go here for this. Although I guess when I think about it, architecture and dance are also high up on the list of programs that UWM is well known for.
And Karen, while we've been talking about funding like this, there is that politically charged question. Does the UW system have more campuses than it can currently afford?
That's going to be an interesting question to watch, because at some point the UW system isn't going to necessarily be able to cut much more. A lot of people would tell you it's already cut to the bone. So then you have to ask, how do you maximize the money that you do have? And maybe it's mergers of campuses. Maybe it's changing the missions. I don't know, but there are certainly a lot of people who are asking that question, is are there too many campuses, and if so, which ones need to be changed? Or I haven't heard of anybody saying a campus needs to be closed, but it certainly is a valid question, and lawmakers would agree with that.
And we had a Facebook comment from Andy on this who said, nobody wants to consolidate campuses, but it really is a bit absurd how many of them we have. Most state university systems have regional campuses, not one for every two or three counties. So there's one Wisconsin Citizens perspective on this. And what have you heard from legislators?
Well, I spoke last week with Senator Darling from River Hills here in suburban Milwaukee, and she said that it's a question that has to be asked, because you think about the number of campuses that we're supporting. You know, you also have debt service, you have buildings. It's a big infrastructure. It's a question that has to be asked, but it is a very difficult political question, because you're talking about an economy in a community. You're talking about jobs in a community. But there are several campuses in northern Wisconsin that are in very close proximity to each other. They already have done some things to, cooperate in terms of, figuring out ways to save money in IT and HR, things like that, with regionalizing that approach in the campuses. But there's going to have to be more of that, no doubt about it.
And Karen, just very briefly as we wrap up here, in the context of history and based on your reporting so far at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, what do you think in terms of this budget squeeze? How tight is it right now?
That is a difficult question to answer. You ask anybody in the UW system, and they'll say that they can't imagine it being any tighter than it already is. You talk to lawmakers, and they say, well, there's some fat that could still be trimmed. Everybody seems to have a different perspective of how tight it is, and I think time is going to tell.
Karen, thanks so much.
Thank you, Veronica.
That was Karen Herzog, higher education reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. She was with us there to talk about some of the challenges, financial especially, facing the UW system campuses after state funding cuts.